Max. Go away tomorrow. 2 weeks. On assignment. Guess where?
LA.
Pittsburgh.
Fabulous. Don't say in the sun too long. Hurt bad in the skin.
Come on. Isn't that where they make videos going?
Hello, everybody. We are back, and we're still in Pittsburgh. The Chopo Pittsburgh road trip continues. It's been a smashing success so far, and I didn't want to end our week here in Pittsburgh or do anything without getting on local luminary and now two-time returning guest Jacob Bacharach. Jacob, thanks for joining us.
I'm still south of Derek Davison, though.
Yeah, that's true. Everyone is gunning for Derek's number one spot in 2017.
It's hard to be the king.
you come at Derek, you best not miss, Jacob. But I'm here with and Felix and Virgil as well. Felix?
Hey, everyone.
Virgil?
Hey. Jacob was so nice to have provided us filtered water tonight. As you guys may have known, I have been drinking tap water from Pittsburgh at a rapid clip. I've already lost 40 IQ points, bringing me down to a very average 260 IQ. However, drinking Jacob's filtered water tonight in conjunction with my new nootropic, Orangutan Cortex, it's bringing me up, and I think if I do a few sit-ups tomorrow, I'm going to be back up around 300.
No, the Pittsburgh trip has been fantastic. We're here in Jacob's living room after he's fed us a lovely meal. We're drinking wine. We're being treated like royalty here in the city of Pittsburgh, which was better when our DC road trip, where we were treated like scum. We were spat upon on the street. We had garbage thrown at us everywhere we went. We ate garbage everywhere we went. Mm-hmm. Like, went through the trash for most of our meals in Washington, D.C.
We slept outside. We were disrespected by man and beast, flora and fauna.
This is what happens when you get out of the bubble into the real America, because Pittsburgh is the Paris of Appalachia, and here you are in the capital, the largest city in Appalachia, experiencing the true hospitality of real salt of the earth people.
Yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm. Animals here respect us.
Yeah.
Every animal we see.
Well, animals always respect me.
Yeah. Every dog that Felix sees, they show them their stomach immediately.
That's just a little thing called respect.
No, but it's been great here in Pittsburgh, certainly in contrast to our D.C. fiasco. But we got a lot of stuff to talk about with Jacob about the history of Pittsburgh and Pennsylvania and some local news and politics. This is what you come to the show for, news about Pittsburgh.
See you in Pittsburgh.
Before we get into that, though, I'm gonna switch things up a little bit. Usually these come at the end of the show, but I want to lead off with it now because we're going to do something new at the end of the show. I'm starting off the show with a reading series, and we're going to end the show with an anti-reading series, which is Jacob is going to do a reading from his new novel. But I call it an anti-reading series because it's actually very good, and everyone should buy the book, respect you, praise you.
Respect women.
Yeah.
Yes,
respect women, but mostly respect Jacob Bacharach and his novel.
But all women are novelists.
I want to read from this piece that came out today, and we read it this morning. We had so much fun going through it that we had to share it on the show. And, of course, I'm talking about this new profile of Scott Adams that came out in Bloomberg just this morning. Scott Adams, of course, we have discussed on the show before. He is the mastermind behind Dilbert, the office-based comic strip. And I think this tunes up nicely as well with a topic we just discussed the other week, which was Garfield. We talked Garf just last week and comic strips. And this is interesting because I think Scott Adams and Dilbert are sort of the dark Jim Davis and Garfield. They're sort of the uncanny doppelganger to the wholesome fun and enjoyment that is Garf and creator Jim Davis. The title of this piece in Bloomberg is How Scott Adams Got Hypnotized by Trump. And the subhead is Come to His Dilbert-Shaped Home, Bite into a Dill Burrito, Be Persuaded on Genocide, Mental Orgasms, and His Fellow Master Wizard, the President of the United States. This is by Caroline Winter, and I have to give her credit because, like all great profiles, I come out of this one with so many more questions about Scott Adams than I had going into it. Now, in the subheading, it talks about Master Wizard, and right away, it says, Scott Adams, the millionaire creator of the office humor comic strip Dilbert, saw something different in Trump. In that moment, he realized he might be a kindred spirit, a fellow master wizard, Adams' term for experts in hypnosis and persuasion. So what do you guys feel about hypnosis and persuasion? Like if you met someone who was like, what are my hobbies? Hypnosis and persuasion.
Very cool person.
Yeah.
Like instantly, they don't do anything weird. They're not fucked up. Just an agreeable person who would never under any circumstances engage in human trafficking.
Those are the kind of people who think having friends is a superpower. I'm a level 12 wizard of having baseline human likability.
I feel like hypnosis is one of those things that, you know, like 30 years ago, there would have been an ad for it in the back of like, you know, like a Reader's Digest or like a Mad magazine. And
yeah.
You would tear it out and send away for like your correspondence course in like hypnosis and persuasion.
your hypno specs.
Your hypno specs. Yeah, absolutely.
Well, I mean, like, again, like the hook of the article is about how Scott Adams went from being this kind of, you know, dorky comic strip guru and like, you know, this likable nerdy figure into being this guy who has become very associated with Trump and like sort of a pseudo alt-right men's rights movement because of his enthusiasm for Trump and hypnotism and game theory and shit like that. And like, you know, he has a blog now that's getting a lot of traffic largely because of his love of Trump and like this sort of alternate storyline he's creating about Trump, which is that it, like what seems like ravings and just like anxieties of like a semi-senile old man, you know, screwing up the country and the presidency like everything else he's done, is actually the chess, like is like the sort of, you know, Kasparov like masterstrokes.
But isn't that the same narrative that a lot of the sort of mainstream liberal critics of Trump also level at him? Isn't there a strange convergence between those two things? You know, that the sort of like notion that like every time he like, you know, like can't go to sleep because he's an incontinent old man and he's just like up late being mad about the news and he tweets some nonsense and they're like, he's just doing this to, you know, distract you from Al Franken's, you know, withering interrogation of Neil Gorsuch. And it's like, no, he's fucking not. He just has like got up in the middle of the night because he had to pee. It burnt. He was mad and he's tweeting. But there's an odd convergence between the like sort of notion, the sort of Scott Adams apparently notion that he's this sort of like master manipulator of like public opinion, and this sort of like master sort of the black art of psychology, and the sort of his principal hashtag resistance opponents.
Yeah, I mean it's the same sort of thing where there's this crafted fiction around Trump that's shared by the cucks and the nationalists. It's the same sort of thing with where both the cucks and the nationalists have to believe that Trump is inherently anti-establishment, even though his entire agenda is just now at this point written and executed by Heritage Foundation drones and Reagan fossils. Who are just doing everything they've wanted to do for 40 fucking years.
Yeah, and he talks about, he wrote this thing, and it says, Adams' essay reframed his actions, speaking of Trump, as the deliberate work of a political savant. Trump, he wrote, was using such persuasion 101 tricks as anchors, intentional exaggeration, and thinking past the sale to wage, quote, three-dimensional chess against his opponents in the media. So, yeah, anchors and intentional exaggeration. These are literary devices as well, Jay. Would you say that actually being a novelist is also about being a master persuader and wizard?
Yeah, certainly. It is definitely about being a wizard and a master of three-dimensional chess. A fictional game with no rules that was invented for Star Trek.
So he talks about his nascent blogging career, and it said, between political ponderings, he blogged about fitness and seduction, posting photos of his abs, and writing a series of essays on how to deploy hypnosis and persuasion for better orgasms.
Oh, yeah, this is... I love when Scott Adams takes his shirt off because he's like, oh, do I look like I'm 55? And it's like, you look like the most 55-year-old man ever. You have the same, like, weird, uneven torso that every old man who isn't fat has. It's all right.
He says, my language skills activate your sex drive, and you know it, he wrote at one point.
Busted, baby. Good Pussy Mondays.
So, this is sort of like the preamble. Caroline Winter, she comes to visit him at his self-designed home in Pleasanton, California. And here's the other thing, like, Scott Adams, like Jim Davis, is now insanely wealthy because of all of, like, the Dilbert, you know, marketing, you know, like, all the franchise, the licensing he's done now with the Dilbert character. So he has a self-designed home, and this is where it gets really good, this glimpse into his life. It says, Adams' house is a shrine to the cartoon character that made him rich. One section, visible from the pool area outside, clearly resembles Dilbert's head, with two oval windows for eyes connected by a thin line that suggests spectacles. Quote, they look out from the cat's bathroom upstairs, Adams told me. Okay, so that's check one. If you're following this at home, just like, you know, put that bingo marker down right now. The cat's bathroom upstairs.
That's the most alpha shit I ever heard.
He has a bathroom just for his cat, which I guess if you're like, you know, a wealthy recluse,
yeah,
that makes sense.
Well, if his language skills don't activate your sexuality, then the cat bathrooms certainly will.
You know who else had cat bathrooms? Genghis Khan, Alexander the Great.
Howard Hughes.
all also sort of moguls in their own right and masters of hypnosis.
Yeah. Alexander as depicted by Oliver Stone.
Yeah.
The structure is full of indulgent quirks. In the kitchen, Adams has installed three microwaves so he can, quote, make a lot of popcorn at once. That's check number two. You know, like, each one of these checks is just another question that has to be asked about Scott Adams. He has three microwaves so that he can make a lot of popcorn at once. Just like, I'm imagining him just like going down his kitchen. There's a bag in each microwave and he's like, boop, 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 and like they all start at the same time, they all start whirring, and he's like, in 4 minutes I'm gonna have so much popcorn.
I imagine him having a whole silo, like Scrooge McDuck style, except instead of being filled with gold bouillon, it's just full of popcorn, and him and his abs constantly just diving into
it's
that
like
shit.
The scene from Scarface where they're laundering the money and the banker's like, oh, how am I gonna launder all this cash? But it's the Instagram model who he dates, and she's like, how are you going to eat all this popcorn?
Nearby, he transformed a bar area, Adams doesn't drink, into a display case for Dilbert books and paraphernalia.
Oh, cool. I'd love to visit this place.
Other features include a 10-seat movie theater, a gym, and a room filled with beauty salon equipment. Okay, that's question number three. Why does he have a room filled with beauty salon equipment? I suppose this is for his model girlfriend, his Instagram model girlfriend.
I just imagine him, every time I'm on this show, I talk about Burn After Reading. I just imagine his beauty model equipment to actually just be the weird sliding dildo chair that George Clooney builds in the basement.
This is to hypnotize my O-ring.
Something, isn't it? $100 all in, not counting my labor and the cost of the dildo. Those things aren't cheap.
Mm-hmm.
See, I'd like the... not set up to mold hard rubber.
Oh, here's I saw an ad for this in a gentleman's magazine, and I thought to myself, I'm a hobbyist.
Oh, wait a second. The article is going to answer my question. I should have read ahead. It says, a room filled with beauty salon equipment, where his ex-wife, now Adam's personal assistant, used to host spa days for her friends. Okay, that's the biggest question of all. His ex-wife is now his personal assistant.
Has he only met like three women in his life?
That yeah. is okay. Sorry.
Well, that's funny because he's like the Bizarro Universe David Brooks, whose personal assistant used to be is now his wife.
Oh my God! Yeah, and wait. One of them is trying to use hypnosis to destroy the establishment, and one's trying to use it to build it up.
To build it up.
Yeah.
Wait, is David Brooks' former research assistant his wife now, or did that personal assistant just fuck up his marriage?
No, I read a report that they are engaged. I don't think that they're married. One way or the other, I do think that they are still currently fucking.
Okay.
Allegedly.
Well, yeah,
allegedly.
No, the sidebar to that. The sidebar to that is that she was his research assistant on his book, The Road to Character, and that's when he started cheating on his wife. And in the acknowledgments to that book, maybe in the first edition, I don't know if it's been scrubbed. Like, I think she's the first person he thanks in the acknowledgments to the book.
Yes, she is. In fact, he thanks her first, and then the very final line of the acknowledgments is something to the effect of, "And I'd also like to thank my wife." He thanks everybody. He thanks the assistant. He thanks his agent. He thanks some fucking Iran-Contra criminal who he met 300 years ago. All these people, and then I'd also like to thank my wife.
He's also like the adjectives he used to just. He was like. I just like I was just amazed by her hungry and giving mind. So Scott Adams, his ex-wife is now his personal assistant, which I gotta say, pretty alpha.
Yeah, that's the epitome of living in Instagram business. Yeah. Like, yo, one moment you're telling me to take out the garbage, the next moment I'm signing your fucking paycheck.
It goes on to talk about how Dilbert came out of his. His experiences working in, offices and shit like that, and how it sort of caught on in the way that other classic strips like Kathy, Dennis the Menace, and Family Circus did of an earlier era.
Al Cap, Beetle Bailey.
Yeah. Then it goes in, he says, we've alluded to her before, he talks about his Instagram girlfriend. When I visited Adam's girlfriend of 3 months, Christina Basham, who is living with him, along with her two daughters... She's 28. Until recently, she maintained a website that showed her posing in a bikini, described as a model and a baker with a D cup size. And then Scott says here, I don't talk about where we met. People make judgments, Adam said. We met the normal way people meet.
You go to an auction on a Sheikh's yacht.
Just normal things, the normal way people meet that I'm not willing to talk about.
I mean, he just was not expecting to meet a female Instagram model on Scruff. It was like just very surprising to him.
Just a regular foot party. Dick Morris's foot party. Everyone goes to it every year. It's very regular.
I don't want to say that I met her on a certain airplane, but...
regular.
So he says, he does blog about Basham, though. In a post titled, The Christina Talent Stack, Adams describes how she increased her Instagram following to 2.5 million. The idea of a talent stack is that you can combine ordinary skills until you have enough of the right kind to be extraordinary. You don't have to be the best in the world at any one thing. All you need to succeed is to be good at a number of skills that fit well together. Basham, he noted, was smart, knew model tricks about posing and makeup, and used social media hacks such as SEO and A/B testing. For example, although her Instagram photos are G-rated, any hint of side boob adds at least 10% to her engagement. What I love about this is like this idea of like the stack. This is becoming one of these words now that have permeated our culture and is used exclusively by idiots, like by tech idiots. And what he's describing here about like you don't need to be extraordinary at one thing. What you need to be is semi-competent in a number of things that fit well together. Again, that's just like talking about just like being an adult, like having a job or like just doing anything.
I think there's so much interesting stuff in this article and Scott Adams specifically because
The old way of conservatism was that you would go, oh, well, you know, you show up at work, you know, if they won't give you a job, just go in and sweep the floors until they give you a job in the mailroom or offer you a job or pay you, and then you're going to be the CEO. It's this very, you know, Protestant work ethic, pull yourself up by the bootstraps, prosperity society. But now, since there are no real middle management jobs, there's no factories, there's really not shit that you can do just out of high school, and now even barely out of college, one of the only industries where you can claim that you can sort of pull yourself up by the bootstraps to be a millionaire is just internet bullshit, which is, yes, what we do. But this is like one of the only areas where you can pretend that there's still this sort of Calvinist, Protestant work ethic, Horatio Alger bullshit. And so you just write endlessly about, you know, optimizing your talent stack for Instagram or your SEO AdSense on YouTube. All these sort of like, not really alt-right, but like Trump-associated people like Scott Adams, like Cernovich, like they all do this. They're all very into it because it's the new culture of sort of conservative prosperity bullshit.
So what's really hysterical, and this is a bit of a digression, but so one of the embarrassing facts about like the history of my life is that like I actually have an MBA. I went to business school, and my capstone sort of like project there was to do a statistical analysis of all of the sort of like marketing streams that we used in the business that I was working in at the time. And the thing that we discovered is that online advertising and online engagement is totally meaningless and does not work. It has no value. It is like, it doesn't matter how many people look at your side boob on Instagram. There is no monetizable value to any of that nonsense.
It's good to know.
Yeah.
No, he says, I'm not much of an artist. This is Scott Adams here. He says, not much of a business expert. And my writing skills are mostly self-taught. I'm funny.
Don't know much about this story.
Don't know much about SEO. He says, I'm funny, but not the funniest person in my town. The reason I can succeed without any world-class skills is that my talent stack is so well-designed.
It's like they want to live in a RPG, but it's just like being a person.
Yeah.
I have +2 dexterity and charisma. That means the barista remembers my name half the time.
Let me just get to the part where he talks about his books. He's written a lot of business books, like one is called How to Fail at Almost Everything and Still Win Big. That sounds like something we do.
That's our shit.
Starting in the late 90s, Adams also launched a line of vitamin-infused vegan microwave burritos called Dill Burritos, which were discontinued after a few years, and 2 restaurants, which went belly up. For a while, everything I touched turned to gold, Adams said, so I tried harder things until I found my limit. The restaurants were my limit. This is where it gets really good.
He tried harder things, all right.
This is where it gets really good. He also wrote 2 religion-themed novellas published in 2001 and 2004, which he told me will be his ultimate legacy, not Dilbert. Dilbert, like the nationally syndicated cartoon strip that is like everywhere and has been like, you know, licensed and advertised everywhere. No, these 2 obscure novellas he wrote, that'll be his.
So he's basically like the James Franco of the alt-right.
Yeah. I just love the idea that he literally has a house that looks like Dilbert, and he's like, my real legacy are going to be these self-published novellas. Okay. This is so good.
Wait till Martin Scorsese makes them into a movie.
The first of these novellas is called God's Debris. that's a beautiful phrase. God's Debris is about a package delivery guy who meets the smartest man on earth.
You're pronouncing it wrong, actually. It's actually a Jewish themed novel, and it's called God's Debris.
The central character in God's Debris knows everything, literally everything, Adams writes in the introduction. This presented a challenge to me as a writer. when you consider all of the things that can be known I don't know much. My solution was to create smart-sounding answers using the Skeptic's Creed. The simplest explanation is usually right.
Skeptic's Creed, by the way, is a video game. It's a stealth game where you sneak around classrooms with a walking stick and call out logical fallacies. Very unpopular.
It was adapted into a movie starring Michael Fassbender.
Yeah.
Okay. The second novella, a follow-up titled The Religion War.
Man, it must have taken him a while to come up with that one.
Describes a civilizational conflict in 2040 between a violent caliphate in the Middle East and a Christian alliance in the West. The hard-nosed hero builds a wall around the jihadists and, quote, essentially kills everybody there, Adams told me. I have to be careful because I'm talking about something pretty close to genocide. So I'm not saying I prefer it. I'm saying I predict it. Yeah, I'm not happy that it happened. It goes on. Around the same time, Adams said, he was making up to $1 million annually from public speaking, charging up to $100,000 per speech, until in 2005, $100,000 a speech to talk to businesses.
Can you imagine paying a guy who draws the same fucking comic strip every day? It's have you finished the Excel spreadsheets yet? No. Do it tomorrow. That's like the whole, that's it. You pay that guy $100,000. Man, you could really talk to our C-suite executives and really make them see things in a different way.
People are always like, you know, what should be the limits on wealth, or should it be limits on income? And it's like, no, it should just be that. If you have enough to pay the Dilbert guy $100,000.
So he says, so he's making $100,000 a crack, $1 million a year giving these speeches. Until 2005, when he suddenly lost the ability to talk with other people.
What, do you have fucking laryngitis?
No, even better. The mysterious condition is known as voice dystonia. While Adams could
still Morgulons.
while Adams could still speak normally to himself and to his cat, and could even sing and recite memorized poems, he could no longer have conversations. I think
that guy lives under a fucking bridge in Pittsburgh.
He says he could sing and recite memorized poems, but he could no longer have conversations. I think that's what led to the end of my marriage, he told me. I lost the ability to talk to my wife. I was incredibly lonely. The inexplicable conditions, which doctors attributed to a possible mental condition, persisted for 3 years.
Actually, his marriage was the only relationship that was totally unaffected by this disorder.
Steve Harvey presents, damn, I can't talk to my wife.
Then Adams underwent an experimental surgery that involved cutting nerves that led from the brain to the vocal cords and building a new path using nerves from elsewhere in the neck. A few months later, his voice returned. So he had some, like, this reminds me of, like,
sing out, Louise.
This reminds me of, like, those stories you hear about, like, the guy who had, like, a piece of rebar go through his brain, like the construction worker, and then he lived and became a totally different person. Like, that would be the condition that would happen if something literally, like went through your skull or something.
He's the Benjamin Bratt character from Doctor Strange.
Spoiler alert for people who haven't seen Doctor Strange.
Sorry. Fuck.
He's the guy who uses mental powers to overcome paralysis.
I channel the magic into my spine.
Will, while we're on the topic, could I share just briefly two of my favorite stories about Scott Adams and Dilbert?
Yeah, go for it.
Number one, so on the topic of hypnosis, 1 year ago, Scott Adams wrote a two-part blog post called Hypnotizing You to Have the Best New Year's Day Ever. And it's... it's a guide to having the best orgasm, and there's a whole 12-part thing, and it's all crap. Like, number three, use pseudo logic. Number seven, visual imagery. Number 10, good girl and good boy are words that society has packed with power. To an alpha personality or someone with a weak ego, they register as an insult. To a submissive, those words are like mental heroin when used in the right context. And so the post...
No, don't ever worry about finding the clit or the G-spot. It's all about good girl.
Now, the post ends with this exhortation to his readers. I'll just read you this paragraph. In order to fully enjoy your New Year's Eve, I want you to find a way to thank me in words, not deeds. This is the part that connects us and makes it real. That feeling of connection will release a different set of feel-good chemistry in your brain that complements your arousal and takes it deeper. On New Year's Eve and the following day, I will be checking my public email account at DilbertCartoonist@gmail.com. You can stay anonymous if
so
you want.
Lame, you can't even get a domain.
But you have to show your respect by thanking me for some of the best orgasms of your life, if not the best. And imagine the grin on my face when I read your message and respond based on your gender with good girl or good boy.
Oh,
Dilbert,
God.
Dilbert fans.
By the way, Chapo fans, everything that Virgil just said applies to us in this show.
Shoot us an email when you come.
I love yeah, show us your cum.
I love clean.
Send it to chapodrafthouse@gmail.com.
I love finishing halfway through and going, no, wait, I have to go tell
I gotta email guy. Scott Adams.
Mr. Dilbert all about this wad I just shot.
So everyone, when you come, email both us and Scott Adams. You can CC them too. And the second thing was obviously, you know, one of my favorite topics, canon and the Dilbert canon. And an answer to a question that I've had for a while, and I'm sure you have as well. Has Dilbert fucked? And
oh, I remember
before
this.
Before I answer this, you remember this, but Will, I'm sure you don't. But what do you think the answer is? You Jacob as well.
Okay, I would say, like, judging by Scott Adams and the Dilbert canon, I would say, unlike John Arbuckle, I would say Dilbert has fucked in the Dilbert universe.
No, I'm going to disagree with you there.
Okay.
Yeah. So, Scott Adams invented a code to alert his fans if Dilbert ever fucked. Reading here, in 7 years of highly defective people...
He hung a hanger on the door of the dorm room.
Adams wrote, many readers asked me to allow Dilbert to lose his innocence with Liz, who was this woman that Dilbert dated briefly, so to speak. But I didn't see any way I could do that in a comic strip and get it past the editors, so I developed a secret sign. I told people who received the Dilbert newsletter that if Dilbert ever got lucky with Liz, I would draw his normally upturned necktie flat that one day. Liz is someone who dated Dilbert for 2 years in the 90s and then cucked him.
Loss of essence, Mandrake.
In this, the last cartoon she appears in, she says to Dilbert, I've decided to date other men. Dilbert says, no, don't break up with me. She says, I'm not. I just want to date other men at the same time. And then another man shows up and she's hugging him and says, that's exactly why I need a spare man.
So Dilbert is a cuck.
Yes. Yeah. Now, regarding the question of has the code ever been triggered, the answer is yes, as multiple people sent me. On August 9th, 1994, before they broke up, Dogbert is sitting in a park with Liz and says to Liz, I don't understand something, Liz. You told Dilbert you don't want to be physical until after marriage. I would expect him to be cranky around the house, yet he's quite relaxed, serene. I don't see how, unless, and the last panel is Dogbert talking to Dilbert. Dogbert says, did you discover religion? And Dilbert, with a downturned tie, says, I think I'm a Unitarian.
Wow.
Wow.
Classic gag.
Dilbert has fucked. Case closed.
Wow. So, like, yeah, that's pretty much, like, all the highlights from the Bloomberg Business Week article. But, like, the other thing that it reminded me of, Jacob, is, like, his whole, the vocal dystonia, like, the sort of that crackpot pseudo-disease or whatever. It reminded me of another thing I know I've talked with you in the past about, which is Glenn Beck's, like migraine problem. He had some made-up migraine disease.
He had adrenal fatigue, didn't he?
It was some crackpot illness, but, like, he sought, like, the help of an experimental chiropractor who put him in one of those, like, big, what is those thing, like, the big rotating spheres or, like, gyroscope, a human gyroscope to cure him.
I mean, all those guys are crack. I mean, Michael Savage, who at dinner earlier evening we were talking about as well. Like, all of those guys are these, like, insane hypochondriacs. And they all believe in the most hysterical, like, crackpot illness. Like, Glenn Beck was like getting headaches because he's like a fat, weird shut-in who like lives in a compound and never goes outside. It's like he could cure his migraines by taking a walk once in a while, but instead he had some like phony baloney doctor come in and strap him into some weird like Dom torture device, which and is like spin him around.
It's like what NASA astronauts do.
I want to bring up one of my favorite books ever. It's called Made in America, The Making of a UFC Champion by Matt Hughes. And look, I'll spare you the long story. But anyway, Matt Hughes is a fucking sociopath, one of the worst people that's ever competed in MMA, and a far right wing evangelical Christian. And obviously, Matt Hughes has a litany of medical problems from wrestling since he was like four and cutting weight and, you know, having over 40 professional fights. He's probably has had more concussions than anyone should have. But at around three quarters of this book, without any introduction, he's like, yeah, that's when I brought the witch doctor on. And the witch doctor was this fellow evangelical Christian that would give Matt these treatments that were voodoo but repurposed as like evangelical semi-Christian science. You know, there are only a few horseshoe theories. One of them is that if you're liberal and conservative, or, you know, far alt-right, you both think that posting is warfare. But the other thing is phony ailments. If you're a Tumblr person, you have some non-specific pain disorder that causes you to be in bed all day. You need donations for this. If you're far right, you have some crank disease that only people from the year 1900 have, whether it's, you know, adrenal fatigue or, you know, voice atrophy.
Yeah, Glenn Beck.
Voice atrophy.
Yeah. I mean, he's like the, what's her name? The character from Deadwood who just takes opium all day long because
Alma
of her
Garrett.
Alma Garrett.
Yes.
Glenn Beck is Alma Garrett.
Yes.
I mean, they're all like these like 19th century characters who are addicted to opiates and require a constant the constant attentions of some like crackpot alcoholic doctor.
Like Trump himself. Trump himself has a doctor that looks like he like runs some type of meat scan. And it's because like Trump probably has just searing headaches from drinking Diet Coke not exercising.
I grew up in relatively rural Western Pennsylvania. Though my family is from Pittsburgh, like I grew up in a small town here, and like Trump's doctor reminds me so much of this doctor from Uniontown, Pennsylvania, Dr. Dilio, who ran the pain clinic.
Oh, yeah.
And was just the major, like, was just the source of
the
of
patient
OxyContin.
Zero for the West,
patient,
Pennsylvania's
zero
opioid
Western
crisis.
Pennsylvania's
I don't
crisis.
See a problem. Connecting yeah. consumers with producers. This is what Enron
yeah,
brought
an entrepreneurial spirit.
You brought up Glenn Beck as Alma Garrett, and now I'm just imagining Doc Cochran, like Brad Dourif, visiting Glenn Beck and trying to be like, Mr. Beck, if I told you that I would put you in the gyroscope, if you had headaches or not, would you that alleviate your guilt, sir?
Glenn Beck isn't too far off from wearing Alma Garrett's elaborately constructed dresses.
You guys know that I met Glenn Beck, don't you?
Yeah, no, I was
no,
going to ask
I did
you
not
about
know
that,
that
in your
I
former job.
That.
Yeah.
All right, so in my former life, my day job was that I was the I was the manager, the director of a performing arts center, and we did all sorts of stuff. You know, we did, you know, fine art, opera, and Broadway and ballet and
Hamilton.
All sorts of different Hamilton. Yeah, coming in 2018. But you know, also did a lot of like commercial presentations. And one time through like this lecture series, we booked Glenn Beck. And I met Glenn Beck, and Glenn Beck is not a human being. He is just a weird semi-autonomous meat puppet who wanders around without being able to communicate to anyone until he walks out on stage, at which point someone via satellite activates whatever is in his head in place of his brain, and then he does the Glenn Beck show for like an hour, and as soon as it ends they turn him off again. He's like Data when they turn the switch on the back of his neck. It's incredible. It's the weirdest person I ever met.
They turn his emotion chip on when he goes out on stage. Yeah, no, I remember
I don't want. He cries too, just like Data. I don't want all these emotions.
No, yeah, you told me that like Yeah, like he'd go on stage and then like do the Christmas sweater and like or something like that and just give and cry and emote on stage. And then he comes off stage and they just turn him off. And like you said, he had some like one of his handlers or whatever was like, would you like to meet Mr. Beck? We'll just bring you over here. And you're like, okay. And you're like, hi, nice to meet you. And you said he was just like, hi. Hello. Totally blank. Yeah. You also said the other celebrity sighting story that you told me was William Shatner.
Oh, William Shatner was amazing.
And you said he had, like, he just goes everywhere with two assistants who are a lesbian couple.
Yes.
And they just have, like, a stack of, like, 8x10 glossies of William Shatner that they just sign.
Well, the other really great thing about Shatner is that, so Shatner is married to a much younger woman who is a sort of, like, aristocratic horse breeder from like bluegrass territory in like Kentucky or Tennessee, I don't remember exactly. And William Shatner is one of those people, like most of the performers who I ever met when I was working in that job are like totally normal people. Like once they get off stage, they're just absolutely ordinary. Like I always tell people, like I talked about the stock market with David Bowie in an elevator. Like they're disappointingly ordinary. But William Shatner is William Shatner. And his wife was trying to get him. He was at this autograph signing. He was smoking a cigar and drinking a scotch and signing autographs. And she was trying to get him to go to this dinner that they were scheduled to go to. And I just remember him like looking at her and being like, woman, why do you vex me?
Oh, God bless the Shat.
He was great.
I suppose now we should move on to talking about some local history and some local history and lore from Western Pennsylvania, because you know we have dedicated our week here to Pittsburgh, and I dedicate the show to Pittsburgh.
I mean, I feel like you should at this point talk about how fucking great this town is.
It's fantastic.
We love it. I fucking love it.
Better than Philly, even.
Oh, I would say so.
I would say so, yeah.
I would say so.
We love Philly. I mean, part of that.
Philly's cool. I like Philly.
We love Philly, too. I mean, we did have a different experience. You know, in Philly, we were only making $500,000 a month. And now we make $50 million a month off Patreon. And so, like, we can afford a better accommodation. So that makes a difference. But it's much more Midwest here, which I like. I, you know, the crowd that we had at the Street Fight show earlier this week, it felt way more, I don't know, Midwest than anything we've ever done. The venue even, or the people in the crowd.
Yeah, like someone in the crowd had like a Harley Davidson like biker cut on. You're not going to find that in Brooklyn. You're not going to find that in our New York City fans, as much as I love them.
Yeah, they all are New York City fans. They work, they're either bike messengers, they work at the bodega, or they are graphic designers for de Blasio.
But I mean, I think that's, I mean, and to not joke about things for a moment, I mean, I actually think that's an interesting thing about the about this city, and about the Midwest in general, but certainly about, like, you know, Pittsburgh, which is the city I know best, which is that, you know, there remains a sort of like interesting working class component to like the left politics in cities like this that I think gets glossed over in the sort of coastal discussion about who is attracted to left politics, and about like this notion that you need to swing right, you know, in order to appeal to people in the Midwest or people in Appalachia. I mean, I saw the Harley Davidson dude, but even aside from that, like, there were a lot of guys in there who, you know, were in like paint stained, you know, sweatshirts and carpenter pants, and it's like, yeah, those guys are actually interested in Street Fight Radio and in Chapo Trap House, and it's like they came out to listen to these, like, no offense, guys, like these like whack jobs yelling about lefty politics in a pizza restaurant in like a weird neighborhood in Pittsburgh. I feel like that's something special, and it's something that's not fully appreciated outside of this part of the country.
To have a little like Tom Friedman moment, everyone that's like just randomly talked to me here, you do get a sense of how dumb that Democrat thing is. Like, all right, well, we lost. To appeal to these people, we have to get extremely racist. And whenever you do talk about politics and you put things in material terms, they will go, no, we should have socialized medicine. We should nationalize all these things. We should probably have a universal basic income. All these things that we are told are just completely off the rails. these people who didn't vote, or, you know, maybe some of them voted for Trump, it's more that they didn't vote. They would very much, there's nothing more fringe to them than this sort of bloodless centrism that was offered to them like a plate under a door in solitary confinement.
Yeah, you just tell people that you, it's like, we're going to give you health care for free. And yeah, people are like, oh, yeah, that sounds great. I got to wait. It costs a fucking arm and a leg to go to the doctor, and I have to wait for 7 months to get there, you know? And in a town like this, that's the sort of thing that resonates with people.
The one thing I want to, like I said, I mentioned I want to talk about some local issues. One of the first things I was told coming here to your neighborhood was not to drink the tap water. Felix has been drinking it nonstop since we got here. Yeah. It's his favorite. It's his favorite meal. Is tap water.
Let me tell you something about psychology, bitch. studies in psychology show that intelligent people have a hard time fitting in. They usually manifest this inability to fit into society with being physically filthy, going to the gym a lot, swearing, procrastinating, sleeping till one, you know, masturbating for 2 hours straight on a single stroke. And so for me to have something in this water that can sort of make me relate to a normal person.
To bring you back down. Will, just a little bit.
Will, you're like a little bit smarter than a normal person. Your IQ is probably like a 95. me, I'm normally like a 378. But right now I'm down to a 300, and that's why I can have this conversation.
Well, so there are two problems with Pittsburgh water.
This is relatively recent, because the last time I was here, I did drink the tap water, or I was not warned.
It's actually
against
the tap water tastes good here, and we actually Western Pennsylvania has some shitty rivers, but also actually has a pretty good watershed. So there are lots of like pretty pure, you know, mountain streams and so forth and so on.
But what I found out is that this is an example of a disastrous privatization.
Yeah,
of municipal. Right.
The Pittsburgh Water and Sewer Authority, which is the public utility that is the water utility for the city, which has been around forever and has always been poorly managed and has always been a sort of semi-private entity. That has board direction, which includes members of the city government, but which is still like a private entity. You know, it's always been a shitty company. They've never been able to like send people bills every month. That's been a big thing with them. They'll skip 3 months and then send you a bill. And when you complain that you just got a $500 water bill, they'll be like, "Oh, that's what you would have paid for 4 months," and you're like, well,
I don't have that in my bank account.
But I don't have that in my bank account right now. So there was they were semi-privatized, and they hired this sort of like French utility firm whose business model is that they basically go into municipalities all over the world and they buy up utilities and they profit from them. And what they did was that they replaced one of the chemicals that's used to clean the water in the water treatment plants with a cheaper chemical. Well, it turned out that one of the effects of that cheaper chemical was that it caused lead to leach out of lead pipes in old service lines. And Pittsburgh, being a very old city with a very old infrastructure, has lots of lead service lines. And so all of a sudden, Pittsburgh's water had a higher lead content in a lot of places than like Flint, Michigan, which everybody's heard about. So that was a huge issue. And it's it's unresolved to this day. It's in litigation. And right now, our mayor's solution is to send everybody lead filters.
Well, it's better than nothing.
Well, I mean, and that's the, again, to talk about the sort of like overall politics of the thing is, you know, the fact of the matter is that to, you know, actually remediate the city infrastructure is too expensive. The money doesn't exist. And so as a consequence, they're forced to take these like stopgap measures. And it's not like the federal government is coming and saying, you know, we'll give you. Figures I've heard have been in the billions of dollars to actually remediate the sort of the water delivery system throughout the city. The consequence of that is that, you know, individuals, you know, they get water filters and hopefully you don't have kids.
You know, drinking water with a lot of lead in it sort of signifies man's triumph over nature, if you think about it. You know, I had a blog post about it. It's called My Water Stack. And it's about me going to Flint, Pittsburgh, you know, all the cities with fucked up water. and then proving that I can survive it. And, you know, how this enhanced my hypnosis ability.
Well, then to add insult to injury, then they also, the water authority, failed to, in one of the main reservoirs in the city, they did not add an adequate amount of chlorine to the water supply. And as a consequence, the entire city for almost 3 days, well, not the entire city, the entire east end of the city for about 3 days could not drink water. They were under a boil water advisory because there was a fear that the Giardia parasite was going to grow in the water supply. So it's been a real bad time for Pittsburgh water.
But this is like, so that's the water story. But like, this is part and parcel of like when we were talking to you the other day. This is like a long history in Pennsylvania of these absurd ecological, these man-made ecological disasters in this state. And I just want to go through a couple of them right now, because like, I was hoping you could like narrate these stories for our listeners.
Absolutely.
So could we begin with the Johnstown flood?
Okay, so the Johnstown flood is an amazing story. Okay, so before the railroads, the main mechanism of mass transportation were canals. And the main line, you may have heard that when you're in Philadelphia, the main line in Pennsylvania was originally a canal transport from the east side of the state to the west side of the state. And in the process of building the mainline canal across the state, the state authorities dammed up a small river, the Connemara River, and created a lake. Once the railroad arrived, like 10 years later, after they'd made this big investment, it was like, fuck, what do we do with this? So they just sold it off to private investors. And the private investors were guys like Henry Clay Frick, Andrew Carnegie, all of these rich Pittsburgh industrialists. So they buy this lake and this dam, and they turn it into a hunting and fishing club. And they subsequently fail to maintain the dam adequately. So years pass. There's a bunch of heavy rains. All of the streams that flow into the lake. It bursts the dam, and there's a bunch of other stories about it, like the fact that like this rich fox who owned the lake lowered the dam so that they could drive carriages across it. Like they actively engaged in the physical destruction of this important dam. So, like a lot of places in western Pennsylvania, the town of Johnstown, which is about an hour and a half east of Pittsburgh, sits in a narrow river valley or a narrow stream valley. The dam bursts. It runs down this valley, a wall of water like 60 feet high, running at 40 miles per hour, runs down this valley, destroys a town of 30,000 people, kills 2,200 people, which is the largest human casualty in the United States up to Pearl Harbor, I believe.
Like what year was this?
Not counting like Civil War battles, yeah. Obviously. 1889. In 1889,
this is the largest mass casualty.
So the largest mass casualty disaster in the United States before like Pearl Harbor,
and the Red Cross was deployed to this in what I think it was you who told me the first post Civil War domestic deployment of the Red Cross.
First post Civil War domestic deployment of it. So and in the state of Pennsylvania, actually, when you buy alcohol, you're still paying the Johnstown flood tax for that. But what's remarkable about it is that it is these kind of like these people who are sort of valorized in this weird way, and sort of like particularly in Pittsburgh history, Andrew Carnegie, who made his start in Pittsburgh before he ever ended up in New York.
All the libraries he built.
All the libraries,
you know,
here.
Yeah.
The museum here is named after him, one of the universities. And then Henry Clay Frick, who was another, you know, huge local.
Yeah,
person.
Frick, but Carnegie especially, is all often held up as like the example of capitalist philanthropy. And what's so great about capitalism is that, you know, he gave back so much. And like this reminds me, of course, of the great Fran Lebowitz line, which is "Don't take to begin with," or i.e., "Don't build your own private dam, fuck it up, and then kill 2,000 people."
And that's really the thing, though. I mean, they didn't build the dam; they bought it, but after they bought it, they fucked it up. They lowered it. They built a road across the top, and then they didn't maintain any of the spillways that are necessary with any dam to release the water pressure. And this was, I mean, a tremendous... I mean, imagine 2,000 people in a town of 30,000 people being killed in a single catastrophe. I mean, it's an extraordinary
story. And the town
story.
Itself was like annihilated.
The town was entirely annihilated.
I was talking with a couple of fans after the Street Fight show who told me about the Johnstown Flood, which I had never ever heard about before. And they characterized it as the closest thing to a socialist Noah's Ark story. And the way they described it was not just massive floodwaters, but what the water went through, the effluvium of these steel mills and these barbed wire factories.
That's exactly right. Well, that's one of the most terrible things that you learn when you read about that flood is that along the way, because this was in, like a lot of Western Pennsylvania, this was an industrial area, the waters picked up locomotives, train cars, barbed wire, fences, pieces of buildings, and a lot of the people who ended up dying in the flood, I mean, aside from the people who were just instantly drowned by the fact that they were hit by a 40-foot tall wall of water, were people who were tangled up in barbed wire and drowned.
That's the last thing we wanted in the floodwaters was the barbed wire.
Some of them were surely workers at these factories as well. And so what they clued me in that in Johnstown today, I haven't had a chance to check any of this, so if I'm incorrect, it's because of these fuckers. In Johnstown today, instead of having like elk lodges or moose lodges or whatever, they have flood lodges, and there are all these memorials to the victims of the flood. But the flood is recognized as an ecological disaster, as not as the man made thing that it was.
Well, so here's a really it's actually quite interesting, is because actually that flood was the basis of a change in tort law in the entire United States, because the victims of the flood and the families of the victims of the flood sued Andrew Carnegie and Henry Clay Frick and the owners of that club, attempting to get damages from them. And the way that the law worked at the time was that because they couldn't prove that any of them was individually and singularly responsible for the flood, none of them paid anything. Also, they had high-priced lawyers, and so, you know, they were able to tie everything up in probate for a long time, but or in appeals. But the public outcry after that changed the way that liability law works in the United States to a strict liability standard, where now it's like, if you have any responsibility for something, you're potentially at risk for damages. So in a way, it had a positive effect on jurisprudence in the United States.
Thank you, Johnstown Flood.
Thank you, Andrew.
You
Carnegie.
Did not die in vain.
All right. I guess we should... That's incredible. But like, quick now, the airborne toxic event.
Oh, okay,
later.
Denora.
This is
so,
yeah.
This was in the 1940s, late 1940s. And so Denora is a town, about 20 minutes southeast of Pittsburgh, along the Monongahela River. What happened is that there were on a lot of towns along that river valley, there were many industrial concerns, and in particular, there was a zinc smelting plant and a number of other plants that were sort of related to the steel industry and to the sort of like metal industry in general. And there was what's called an atmospheric inversion, which is where a mass of warm air in the higher atmosphere traps a mass of cold air underneath, and it caused a toxic smog that was full of like nitric acid to settle over this town, and it ended up, I want to say it killed like 50 people and sickened hundreds of people over a course of about 3 days in the 1940s, and then was very rarely talked about afterward until the mid-90s when they built a museum.
Until White Noise was published.
Until White Noise. But yeah, it was an actual airborne toxic event. Produced by these metal smelting plants that were located along this river valley, and again the geography of Western Pennsylvania is such that a cloud of toxic gas got trapped in between two hills in a river valley and killed a bunch of people in this little town outside of Pittsburgh.
And then last but not least, this is not so close to Pittsburgh, but Centralia, Pennsylvania, and the ongoing underground fire. I'm still very impressed by this one.
Yeah, it's so Centralia was a anthracite coal mining town. It's a little more in the eastern end of the state, a little more up towards like the Wilkes-Barre Scranton area, closer to you guys in New York, so you could go and visit.
I would love to. Well, actually, we're gonna record the next show.
The next show in Centralia. You'll have a hard time because they've demolished the highway leading into the town. This is another fascinating story because there is an underground mine fire. It is a coal seam. So coal obviously is combustible. We use it to produce electricity, and we do that to, you know, by burning it.
Steam electricity.
Steam, yeah, bullshit electricity. So a coal seam underneath what used to be a town caught on fire and has been burning since the 1960s. At earliest the 1960s, it could have been even earlier than that, but that's the commonly sort of accepted beginning. So for, 60 years now? And there are some estimates that this fire, this underground fire, could burn in this coal seam for up to 250 years. And there are a lot of theories about what started it, but one of the most common theory about what started it is that, so the town, before this fire started, had a couple of garbage dumps, and the town elders, the town leadership, decided they wanted to get rid of some of the garbage in the garbage dumps. And so they had their volunteer fire department go and set fires in the dumps to just do trash fires, to burn the fire. And that in so doing, they created a fire which somehow found its way into the underground mine shafts, which run all underneath much of Pennsylvania, caught this coal seam on fire, and has now been burning. So in these tunnels underneath this town are fires that burn hotter than the surface of the planet Mercury.
Holy shit.
Yeah, you can melt lead in these. Lead, we come full circle, Pittsburgh. You can melt lead in these tunnels. It's astonishing. And it's been going on for 60 years.
So, guys, everything Jacob just told you, that's how cool things used to be before safe spaces, before gender, before affirmative action.
Before the fucking EPA.
Yeah, before the EPA, before all this bullshit that we have today. So what it used to be to be a real man. Used to get killed by a flood.
Killed by a barbed wire
flood. Gas coming from the sky. Yeah. And you didn't need to check your privilege.
My dear husband, your five sons have been killed by a barbed wire driven by a flood down the Johnstown Valley.
Do you think they took bereavement days when five of their kids died? No. They either said
they went to work.
They went to work because they made 15 other kids. Or if they didn't, they said, we're going to make some more.
When I was your age, I was killed by a flood on the way to work. Yeah. And I was killed by a flood on the way home afterward. Yeah.
When we would play baseball, we'd play it in the mines and get burned alive and die. And with no remains.
You say that's hotter than the surface of Mercury? Shit. We just cooked hot dogs on that.
That's right. That's right. So you've been listening to The Way Things Were and Ought to Be. Jacob Bachrach.
So, yeah. Coming back again, we started talking about, Pennsylvania and the Pittsburgh surrounding area's history of ecological disasters, your current water crisis, which has to do with shady local politics and like semi-public-private concerns, which is a major feature of your current novel.
That's true.
The doorposts of your house and you're on your gates. Yes. Out now.
Out now. Yeah, wherever fine books are sold. Yes. Well, it's based in much of the public works shenanigans go on in an earlier period, in a more innocent time, the 1980s.
The go-go 1980s.
The 1980s and the 1990s, when Western Pennsylvania was involved in constructing a giant highway project connecting the city of Pittsburgh through a bunch of disinvested communities in old river valleys that have in no way benefited from that investment.
A big threat of this novel is one of the main characters, Abby. I mean, does become a real estate speculator and huckster. He moves from New York in the go-go 80s to Pennsylvania based on what he believes is a vision from God to become a real estate speculator and buying up properties surrounding a highway to nowhere in Western Pennsylvania. So I want you to do a reading from this book. But before we do, could you just like give the listeners like what is the plot here? What's the pitch? What's going on?
Yeah, sure. So I was really interested in the story of Abraham and Isaac, Abraham in particular, leading into Isaac in the Old Testament, because like all of the stories of the biblical patriarchs and basically the story of Judaism in general, it is a story of real estate speculation. It's a bunch of like really shitty dads constantly making their families move to shitty towns in order to take them over and try to make a bunch of money there. And so I was really fascinated by that story, and I wanted to sort of set it in contemporary times. And so I set it in Western Pennsylvania. I had this whack job family who wherein the patriarch thinks that he's had a vision from God, move from New York, the biblical Ur, to Western Pennsylvania, in which he forgoes his pagan life as an architect to become a property speculator. And then many years later, a young woman who has a connection to him, who has a connection to him, moves out there as well and gets caught up in the family drama.
It's like it sort of like alternates between Isabel, this woman who is your Ishmael.
Yes.
Which is very clever, Jacob.
Oh, yes, thank you.
She also moves from New York to Western Pennsylvania. She meets Isaac, the son of Abby, and begins to ingratiate herself into the lives of this kind of crazy family who live in this like big mansion in like the woods in Western Pennsylvania. But she has ulterior motives for doing so. And she begins to ingratiate herself into the life of this family. And in doing so reveals more of their backstory and history of this, like the weird fraught past of this family and like their reasons for moving to Pennsylvania and this real estate con.
Yes. In some ways, if you actually go back and look at the original the original texts of the Abraham Isaac narratives, what you see is that there's actually this really interesting sibling relationship between Ishmael, who's the first son of Abraham, and Isaac by his concubine, and Isaac, who is the second son of Abraham through his wife, and that was one of the things that I wanted to sort of try to explore.
All right. Well, now debuting now on Chapo Trap House, the Chapo Trap House anti reading series. So we're gonna read a short selection from your book now, Jacob.
All right. So I guess I should set this up. Isabel, the Ishmael character, she has at this point just moved to Pittsburgh, and
just like us,
just like you guys. The Chapo boys are never going to leave Pittsburgh. They are here to stay. So she has moved to Pittsburgh, and she is at a party that is hosted by her new boss, who runs a nonprofit institute called the Future Cities Institute. And so this is her sort of his name is Barry, and she's at the introductory party at his house. And this is where she first meets Isaac, who is the son of the Abraham character in this book. His house is a sort of fancy modern house in the fancy East End of Pittsburgh. And here goes. Like his home, Barry's parties tended toward the tableau. They had the quality of being displayed in a vitrine, which wasn't diminished by the fact that he lived in a glass house. He had invited a few members of his advisory board, our advisory board, Isabel reminded herself, who were a serially uninteresting gang of university faculty, nonprofit administrators, the rich, and the bored. They talked to her and to each other as if they were leading a class of morose and sleep-deprived undergraduates. And of course, one of them said to her, when you have a high municipal parking tax, and he trailed off and gave her a quizzical look that simultaneously suggested he expected her to answer and hoped that she would not. You have high parking rates, he said at last, and then, after a beat, he added,
which is the problem.
Their conversation ultimately regressed to the conversation that any similar gathering has when it thinks no one who could possibly disagree is listening. The general inability of popular democracy to arrive at the fair and obvious technocratic solutions necessary to the smooth running of a society. It's practically an article of faith among such people. They were inoffensive but banal, and the dinner was only saved by two guests. The first, introduced to Isabel as, quote, a supporter of the Institute, was Arthur B. Imlach. She recognized the name vaguely but couldn't place it. He was, he told her, one of the richest men in the Commonwealth, using exactly that phrase. Oh, she said. Marcellus Shale. He smirked, but there was something self-deprecating about the look, something practiced, as if he'd just revealed a mild fetish. Aha, she replied. Barry, he told her, despises my business on general principle, but feels that the FCI is a wastewater treatment plant for the endless river of slurry that is my money. Then, abruptly, he said, do you sail? She grinned at him. It was such a preposterous question. I can't say that I do, she told him. Never, he asked, and he pulled a comical pout. Well, I have a boat, he interrupted, down in Clearwater, a 60-foot trimaran. I call her the Shale Boat. That's very clever, she told him. Well, Ms. Giordani, he told her, you just let me know when you're interested in putting on those sailing shoes. Now he grinned at her, and she was about to reply, but Barry interjected from the far end of the table. Is Art telling you about his boat? He loves that goddamn boat. Barry came down one time, Imlach said, performing for everyone now. He fell off the dock. Imlach was handsome, though he was growing into a recently acquired middle-aged belly. He had silver hair and a slightly shabby jacket of a man with a very large fortune. Isabel noticed a preposterous watch glancing out from under his cuff. When he looked at her, his eyes winked with a cursory flirtatiousness that she felt sure was obligatory, not a nod to an expected role. There was interest in there somewhere, but it wasn't sexual. It was for something else, something more obscure and therefore more unsettling. His voice was patrician, but with an edge of the coal patch to it. My father dug coal, he told her another time, after he'd got a few drinks in him. Then the mines closed, and it ruined most people down here in Fayette County. But Dad had been smart and bought up some old houses in Uniontown and turned them into apartments. And that was where I got my start, buying up shitbag properties and leasing them to shitbag tenants. Then I got into land. A man is not a man until a man owns land. He'd also made this latter statement on the night of Barry's dinner, apropos nothing, and everyone had tittered nervously. Later that night, he followed Isabel into a bathroom and offered her a blast. A what? She said. A blast, he said, and he mimed it. Oh, she said. A blast. She had a weakness for cocaine, and she declined, knowing that if she accepted, she'd want more within the half hour. Pretend I was harassing you in here, he said. I have a reputation. Will do, she assured him. What on earth are you doing in Pittsburgh? He asked her. She said it was too soon to tell. Well, we're very pleased to welcome you to our little kingdom. I hope we can keep you. Isabel had arrived late. Barry didn't appreciate lateness and made a cursory introduction, although Isaac, younger than Isabel by at least 10 years and younger than everyone else by at least 30, carried with him, even more than Imlach did, a sense of imperturbable importance. Even Barry responded with deference. In fact, Isaac almost resembled Imlach, a more gauntly drawn version of the older man. They might have been distant relatives, and they greeted each other with the casual familiarity of old friends who didn't feel the need to spend any more of the evening talking to each other. Isaac spent most of the meal chatting with the wife of one of the advisors, a woman who ran the Alliance Française de Pittsburgh. They spoke in a rapid Parisian French that Isabel couldn't understand, despite having studied in France for a year as an undergrad. Isaac was wearing a completely preposterous outfit, a blousy white chemise,
and a pair of brown jodhpurs. He was very thin and so pale that, when lit from behind, he appeared almost translucent at the edges. He had fine features that you would call effeminate if you didn't look closely. Closely considered, he was rather wolfish, or like one of those feral dogs that rise the Moscow subway, emaciated and obviously built to survive. His hair flopped all over, effortlessly stylish. He had a hint of stubble, barely a shadow, that must have taken him a week to grow. When Isabel came back from the bathroom, he was describing a building to the table. "We call it the Gamelands," he said, "although technically it's just outside of the state Gamelands. Anyway, you come to the end of this drive and you can barely see it. From that side, it's half dug into the hillside. It sort of looks like a lot of rocks. You know, it's all very green. But if you walk to the end of the field on the other side and look back, it looks like a bunch of fucking glass and concrete teepees. It's supposed to be his masterwork, but I am pretty sure he was stoned when he did it. If it's still around 1,000 years from now, someone's going to think the aliens built it." "What's the building?" Isabel asked as she sat down. "The Gamelands," he said. He laughed. "My family estate, compound." "It's not in Pittsburgh, I take it?" "It's in Uniontown," he said, "or outside. Anyway, I have an apartment in the city. The Gamelands is the family house, Mom and Dad, and me when I'm there." He smirked. "And of course," he said, "there's a monster in the woods." "Ha," she said. "A monster, huh?" "According to Abby," Isaac answered. He laughed again, and Barry asked who wanted coffee or dessert. After everyone left, Barry had Isabel stay for a nightcap and to chat about her schedule for the first week. Starting on Thursday, she asked him, "Who was that kid?" "That kid," he said. He probably hadn't needed the last scotch. "Oh, that's Isaac. He's Abby's son." "Abby?" "Abby Mayer," Barry said. "You know." "Oh, shit," Isabel said. "Oh, oh." "Oh," Barry said, "you know him." "No, no, I know of him. I know of his work. I know he lives in Pittsburgh." "Lived," Barry said. "He lives on top of a mountain now, doing God knows what. You ought to see the house, though. Isaac didn't do it justice." How much should she say? "I love his, well, work. He disappeared. He came out here in the late 80s, early 90s. He was a prick back then, too, although I, like you, admired his work." "Admired," Isabel said. "Yes. Anyway, the son does seem interesting." "Honey," Barry said. "That kid is fucked up."
Jacob Bachrock, thank you so much for hosting us, escorting us around town. And to everyone, the novel is The Doorposts of Your House and On Your Gates. It's out now.
Yeah, looks like I may be breaking my notebooks rule.
It's really great. There is a monster in the woods.
It's only 20 pages long, many illustrations.
And most
it rhymes.
Most right. Importantly, if you're a fan of the show, I edited it. So yeah. If you like the show, you'll love the book. Jacob, thanks again for joining us.
Thank you.
Cheers.
And thank you. Welcome to Pittsburgh.